Hey, everyone. Welcome into another Pipeline podcast. Tim McMaster here, along with MLB Pipeline's Jim Callis and Jonathan Mayo. Lots to get to on this podcast. You guys were at the Rookie Career Development Program last weekend. We're going to get into that a little bit, hear from some of the prospects that were there, and get your thoughts on what the program was all about this time around and who impressed you as far as the players go. We'll also get the executives' pick on who should be the number one prospect in baseball when the top 100 comes out later in the month, and we'll talk about that top 100 a little more as far as strengths and weaknesses. First, I want to get out the calendar so people know the top 10s are coming first, and they're coming soon. Tuesday, January 16th, top 10 right-handed pitchers. Then it'll be left-handed pitchers on the 17th, catchers on the 18th, first base 19th, second base the 22nd, as we take the weekends off, the 23rd on is third baseman, shortstops on the 24th, outfielders the 25th, and then the top 100 list will go up on January 27th. That'll go along with the special on MLB Network, where you guys will break it all down. So plenty of stuff coming up on that front. They are underway full production-wise as far as videos go. So let's get into that top 100, just generally speaking, because we don't want to give anything away at this point before any of these lists are out. But strengths and weaknesses of this top 100 as you guys start to break it down. Jonathan, I'll start with you. What's a position that really stands out to you as far as prospects in these lists right now?
Well, I mean, the easy choice is pitching, because there's always a lot of pitching. But I'll actually say, to me, the one that seems, I think, is surprising us is not surprise me, is outfield. There's always a good group of outfielders from top to bottom, but I feel like it's even better this year. It's even deeper this year. I think the emergence of Ronald Acuna and Victor Robles, who obviously, I'm not giving anything away, is that they're near the top of lists. Things like that, but all the way down and even beyond what the top 10 list will look like. I feel like there were a lot more outfielders this year to choose from and to put onto the top 100.
Jim, is there another list to you or another grouping that stands out more than normal on this list?
I'd say more than normal. I'd say maybe third base. I think it's not going to, again, reveal too much to say that Vladimir Guerrero Jr. and Nick Senzel are two of the 10 best prospects in baseball. And then I think there's some depth behind that with guys like Miguel Andujar and Christian Arroyo and Michael Chavis and Austin Riley and Colton Welker and Ryan Mountcastle and on and on and on. I know it's like there's some years where it seems like, Jonathan, and I think you probably agree with this, where when we're filling out the top 10 third baseman list, because we do top 10s for each position, even if the top 100 itself does not fill them out, there's some years where we're kind of scraping, trying to figure out what third baseman we're going to put on the end of the list. And I really felt like among the lists that we had to fill out this year, third base was the easiest. We had plenty of candidates. We probably could have gone 15 deep with third baseman we liked if we had to.
Yeah, no, I agree. I do agree with that. Just very quick on that. It's true. Even if they always feel like I have to remind people that, even if, say, the end of the top 10 third baseman list, they're not all top 100 guys, that doesn't mean that there aren't quality players at that position. And you're right. There was a stretch where it was tough finding legitimate third base prospects. And there's even the non-top 100 guys and the guys that aren't on the list are really interesting and are the kind of guys you want to keep track of and see if they take step forwards in 2018.
How about on the other side of things, and Jim, you can go first on this, how about a weak position, maybe even a position that's normally a strength that just doesn't kind of live up to the normal billing as far as top 100 talent?
I don't know if there's any position that jumped out at me as unusually weak this year. I know we kind of kicked this around a little bit, and I think Jonathan thought the shortstops weren't as strong as it's been, but I actually think that's because we've had these ridiculous shortstops coming up, and I still think the shortstop list, at least to me, looks pretty strong. Starting off with guys like Gleyber Torres and Fernando Tatis and Brendan Rodgers and Bo Bichette and Royce Lewis, I mean, that's five pretty good shortstops right there, all of whom are going to rank in the upper fourth of our list, and there's more behind them as well. The weakest position, I think, most years, and it probably was the most difficult to fill out again this year, was probably second base. I mean, there are some good ones out there. You know, we'll have at least three in the top 100, starting with Luis Urias. But, I mean, I think a lot of our big league second basemen are former shortstops. There's some guys on our shortstop list right now who might wind up at second base. But I think second base is usually the weakest of the positions. You know, catchers, I thought the catchers were okay. I mean, that's usually not the deepest list, but I felt second base was the weakest. I don't know if Jonathan will second my thoughts on that one.
Go ahead, Jonathan.
Yeah, I think second base or first base was weak. First base, I feel, has been weak for a while. I feel like every time, like when we're trying to help figure out who's going to be in the futures game, finding first baseman sometimes can be tough. And I guess it's just the shortstops. I think you're right, and you did tick off, you know, premium guys at the top, and they're all really good. And maybe it was spoiled, you know, with the run of young shortstops that have come through. I guess Ahmed Rosario was the last of the sort of upper echelon guys to graduate. And it, to me, the bottom part of the list didn't jump out at me as much as in other years, where, you know, I thought they were just like, we could have gone on with an endless supply of, you know, top 100 caliber shortstops on the top 10 shortstop list. So I think that's kind of what that sort of spoke to me a little bit when we were considering this.
Interesting that you mentioned first baseman. The reason I say that is because last year's draft was actually strong for first baseman. So does that mean there's help on the way maybe for that position?
Yeah, I think that's probably fair because, I mean, you have Brennan McKay, Pavin Smith, Nick Prado, and Evan White are all on our list, and they haven't really had a chance to do a whole lot yet. You know, and so you're right. That's a good observation, Tim. I mean, if those guys come out and perform, you know, up to their draft status and are as good as we thought they were, we may be looking at it a year from now saying, boy, this first base list is pretty good. Because I think from the other direction, the only first baseman who probably is going to graduate this year off that list would be Ryan McMahon. So the rest of the guys will probably all return, and some of those guys should have higher profiles.
All right. Well, last week we talked about the guys that were in the discussion for the top prospect overall. We talked about Shohei Ohtani, mm-hmm. Ronald Acuna, Vlad Guerrero into that discussion as well. And Jim, you went out and asked a lot of executives around the league, scouts, executives. I think that was the way you broke it down, not necessarily GMs, but people in front offices, to get their takes. And the results are in. You have a story up on the site. And Ohtani, no surprise, was number one, but not by a landslide. 10 votes for Ohtani. Acuna came in with 8 votes, and then that was really the big two. They ran away. After that, it was single votes for a bunch of other guys, including Vladimir Guerrero Jr. But, Jim, were you surprised at all by the results? Not, I guess, by Ohtani, but the fact that maybe it was as close as it was, and it was really a two-player race.
Yeah, you know, not surprised Ohtani. I mean, we kind of knew going in, and I had to remind people, too, that he's eligible because some people consider him more of a Japanese big leaguer, but he is rookie eligible. He meets our prospect definition. So I had a little, not grumbling, but a couple guys who said, well, if we're counting him, it's clearly Ohtani. But maybe a little surprised. I mean, as good as Ohtani is, I mean, there are questions. I mean, we've talked about it. I mean, he had a PRP injection in his elbow. Some people worry about that. You know, some people wonder about, you know, if trying to do both hitting and pitching is going to detract from both. You know, he does swing and miss a lot. So it's not like he's, you know, without some red flags or it's probably nitpicking, but it's not like he's, you know, like if Ohtani struggles, it's not like everybody can say, oh, I didn't see that coming at all. You know, he's going to have to make some adjustments. I think it just speaks to how highly Ronald Acuna is regarded. I mean, if we were just comparing these guys as hitters, which isn't really fair to Ohtani because I think more guys like him more as a pitcher, but if you're just comparing them as position players, then I think Acuna is the better prospect. But I did think the two most interesting things about the overall prospect voting were the fact that Acuna made it as close as he did, and that you mentioned, you know, we had 22 respondents. So Ohtani got 8 votes. Ohtani got 10 votes. Acuna got 8 votes. And 4 other guys got a vote. You mentioned Vladimir Guerrero. Eloy Jimenez and Fernando Tatis Jr. Were kind of interesting. I could see that. But I thought the most interesting vote cast was for Forrest Whitley, who You know, obviously he's highly regarded. He's one of only five guys this decade to go in the first round out of high school and reach Double A the next year. And the other guys are all pretty good pitchers. You know, Kershaw, Greinke, Dylan Bundy, who's come back from injury, and Cole Billingsley, who is an all-star. So that's a pretty good group. But I would not have seen somebody necessarily voting for Forrest Whitley as the best prospect in all of baseball. I thought that was maybe the most interesting vote. See, I'm lobbying here. We could get obvious sponsorship tie-in if I keep saying most interesting, and maybe that'll come true for us.
One of the things that sort of spoke to me in that story, and I was a little envious because I've done that, you know, the sort of executive polling story the last couple of years, so it was hard for me to let go of. But with this sort of idea, because everyone talks about Ohtani, you know, as the number one prospect because he can do two things incredibly well, and he'll be highly rated on our right-handed pitchers list. He'll be highly rated on the outfielders list. We've never had that before, and it's almost hard to evaluate him. But I thought it was sort of interesting the idea that the potential of him actually reaching his ceiling might be lessened because he's splitting his focus and his energies. Meaning, like, if you're only pitching, he might reach his ceiling as the best pitching prospect in baseball and become the best, you know, starter in the big leagues. If he were just an outfielder, maybe he'd be one of the top few outfielders in the big leagues. But because he's doing both, it's like the very thing that makes him such an exciting prospect, the ability to play both ways, is something that could actually hurt him, or not hurt him, but keep him from reaching, you know, the ultimate ceiling either way. And that, you know, and as much as I agree that people voted for Acuña because Acuña is really, really good, I think that, you know, there was that someone considered that, I thought was really interesting.
Yeah, you know, it's like the philosophical question too. Would you rather have somebody who's good at both or great at one? And I think, and we've talked about this before too, we're not critical of the Angels. I mean, I don't think you were signing Ohtani unless you agreed to let him do both. So, like, it's not a case of are the Angels making a mistake. I don't think if the Angels were steadfast, hey, we only want you to pitch or we only want you to hit, then I don't think they land Ohtani. So I think they did this, what they had to do. I think the interesting discussion, and he didn't factor into this, but, you know, the Rays are still open to kind of letting Brendan McKay find his way as both a hitter and a pitcher as well. And, you know, personally, you know, did they have control over that one? I mean, he wasn't going to turn down a $7 million plus bonus. I would, as an organization, decide what you think he's better at. I think it's as a hitter. I think a lot of people would say pitcher. It's probably close to a 50-50 split. But, you know, and that's a case where they do have a decision. It's hard enough to be good at either. I would let him focus on one. But so I'll be curious, like Jonathan said, I'm curious to see whether doing both, like, detracts from Ohtani's overall greatness. You know, and he's merely good at both, which would still be an extremely useful player. And I'm also very curious as to how long the Rays will let Brendan McKay attempt to do both.
Maybe as far as Ohtani goes, it depends on the team and needs, too. Maybe for some teams, they're better off having a guy that can pitch and be very good and hit and be very good to fill two spaces as opposed to having him great at one or the other. I mean, as far as I guess his greatness and his ceiling maybe doesn't get reached, but that doesn't necessarily mean he isn't maximizing his value to a certain team. All great questions and certainly a good discussion and something that we'll be keeping our eye on throughout the season. All right, one little inbox question that Jonathan got this week that I wanted to touch on. Always good stuff from the people out there that weigh into the inboxes. But somebody wanted to know, Jonathan, who is the 2018 version of Rhys Hoskins? Different ways to look at that. I think one of them is just a guy that wasn't a top prospect that became really one of the best prospects in an organization quickly throughout one season. What was your approach to answering it, and who is your answer?
Yeah, I kind of looked at it more of a guy, you know, not in the top 10, who will jump more firmly on the prospect map in 2018 and not necessarily make a big league impact. And I think you could look at it either way, but that's how I chose. And I went with Monty Harrison, who we were all abuzz about because Jim and I both saw him in the Arizona Fall League. Our colleague Mike Rosenbaum did as well. And the amazing thing is, you know, he was only a taxi squad player, so he was playing twice a week. But he was one of those guys that every time he was on the field, you could not take your eyes off him. You wanted to watch him take BP. You wanted to see his at-bats. You wanted to see him in the outfield. You wanted to see him throw. Add to the fact that he's just got a tremendous personality, which has nothing to do with where we rank him, but makes you want to root for him a little bit more. He was already coming off a really good season where he put some injuries behind him and some early struggles. Made it out of low A. This guy was drafted in 2014, so it took him a while to get going. But finished 2020, unbelievably toolsy, but he's really starting to figure it out. He was number 14 on the current Brewers list. And without giving anything away, he is going to be making a large jump up in the preseason. I can't wait to see what he does for an encore, that's for sure.
Yeah, I share Jonathan's enthusiasm for Harrison. This was a question. I did not put as much thought into this as Jonathan because he wrote the inbox, and I learned that we would discuss this particular question right before we jumped on the podcast. I'm just saying. You've given a more considered answer. I'm going to approach this the same way you did. I'm not necessarily looking for a guy who's going to make a big league impact like Rhys Hoskins, but as a guy who I think is going to really increase his prospect profile this year. And that's Brusdar Gratterall of the Twins, right-handed pitcher. He came back from Tommy John surgery last year. And, I don't do our Twins list. I think you do, Jonathan. And he sounds fascinating to me. I mean, he's upper 90s. He can touch 101. He's got a pair of power breaking balls. He's got some feel for a changeup. He threw, pretty decent amount of strikes for a guy in his first year back from Tommy John surgery. I'm looking here, number 12 on our Twins list right now. If he comes out in full season ball and maintains that same kind of stuff, then he's a guy who could, push for being on the top 100 prospect list. I mean, he's a guy that frankly, I didn't know much about at all before 2017. He wasn't a big-ticket international guy. But I think now that he's healthy and puts that Tommy John further behind him, he's got the stuff to jump up prospect lists heading, during the 2018 season.
Okay, before we move on, we want to take a second to tell you about the Fantasy 411 podcast. It's never too early to start prepping for your 2018 fantasy draft, and listening to the 411 with Fred Zinke and Matthew Leach can give you an edge no matter what format you play. They'll break down the latest hot stove news all off season, including how to value old faces in new places like Wade Davis, Jolys Chacin, and new D-backs reliever Hoshihisa Hirano. Draft time will be here before you know it, so subscribe to Fantasy 411 podcast on Apple Podcasts today. All right, let's get on to the rookie career development program. You guys were down in the Virginia side of Washington, D.C. A lot of great players were down there this year. A good program, I believe, good time was had by all, and these players learned a lot, and you caught up with a lot of them. We want to hear from some of them and kind of go down the list and hear your thoughts from each of the guys. So, Jonathan, I'll start with one of the guys you were able to catch up with, and that was, and make sure I'm pronouncing this right, because it's just one name that always kills me, Rowdy Tellez.
Yep.
Is that right? Yay. All right. Yep. I don't know why that's even a hard name, because it's not, but for some reason it sticks in my head. Anyway, the Blue Jays' number 12 prospect right now before the new list come out. He's a burly first baseman. He talked a little bit about battling through 2017 and really how the team was able to stick with him, his appreciation for that. So let's hear from Tellez.
I wouldn't say anything really went wrong. There was I had a little adversity with my family and health issues, and I really didn't know how to handle those. And I'd say it affected the way I played, the way I was on the field, but I kind of let it get to me subconsciously, I think. But I tried to go to the field every day, same guy, day in and day out, smile on my face, respected the game, respected my staff. They were also there for me to help me through my tough situation, but I couldn't be more grateful again for the Blue Jays and what they meant to me and what they helped me with, just talking to me and making sure everything was okay and offering any help that I needed if it arised. It's hard to compartmentalize about, your family, and people do sometimes. Even we as players forget that, we have our own lives. We're so caught up in how we're doing that day or how our team's doing. But, when family events like that happen, it is hard sometimes to go back and forth and really understand, we live our own lives too, and we have a job to handle, but we also have a family to take care of and support. Family's everything to me. I was raised to be really close with my family. And so when the event happened, it was really hard to handle. And I think I took it harder than anybody, being that I don't live with my family. I live, you know, across the country in Florida now. But it was a difficult transition, and it was hard to understand. And I was really thankful the Blue Jays were able to keep people in my corner to help me throughout the year with learning how to handle that and how to deal with adversity, not just on the field and struggles, but the adversity of, you know, everything happens for a reason, and family struggles are a part of life. And how do you handle those while you're going through a season that, you know, is in AAA, is you're a phone call away from the top. So, again, the Blue Jays helped me a lot through all this.
Jonathan, that was not the entire interview, but a little of it. What else did you take from talking to Rowdy?
He may have been the best talker at the program. The ease of the conversation. Like, sometimes even the guys who are good, you know, you're so aware of doing an interview, and I felt like we were having a conversation. And he was very, open about the struggles that he had. And then talking to him off camera, his mother had been very ill, and that was really what distracted him. And he never wanted to make an excuse. I think that he just is a really thoughtful guy, kind of like a gentle giant in some regards. And he gave great answers to our cut four questions. We asked him a celebrity look-alike and crazy thing that happened to him, and he gave really good answers for that. And then the last little tidbit, which had I realized that, I would have asked him about on camera, but he could have played for four different World Baseball Classic teams. He could have played for the United States, which obviously is not going to happen given the makeup of that team. He could have played for Mexico, which I think maybe he did. I'd have to go check. He could have played for Israel because his mother is Jewish. And he could have played for Spain because I think one of his grandparents was from Spain. So I don't know if there are too many other guys who could have played for four different WBC teams.
Yeah, good stuff, and it'll be interesting to keep an eye on him with his mind cleared in 2018, what he can do. Jim, you talked to Derek Fisher. What a season he had. We've talked about in the RCDP. Some of these guys have made their way to the big leagues, and Derek Fisher didn't just do that, but he scored the winning run in one of the greatest World Series games ever played. Not bad for the Houston Astros. Let's hear what Derek Fisher had to say.
You know, I think it's big for all of us because – you can never hear enough of what we're hearing, and there's a reason why we're hearing so much of it, is because it continues to happen, and there's some of them are good and some are bad, but you continue to hear about it for a reason. So when you continue to hear about things like that, you start to take a little bit more of an initiative to, like, the people around you and the things that you're doing on a day-to-day basis, because they really do affect you. This whole year has been pretty tremendous. I mean, with the team that we were able to put together, and being, pretty familiar with that team in spring training. I spent the whole time in spring training with them, and being able to just pick their brains, just understand the people that they were. And then obviously from the outside looking in, as the whole country saw, I mean, before I was even there, just watching games every day, just to be able to see, like, this team has a lot of fun. And I just wanted to be a part of it and be able to just contribute to a team that questionably is one of the best ever. And I think for somebody like me or anyone that could have been in that position, it was a lot of fun just to be with that group and do what we did, because it was something that obviously we'd been pushing for so long. Preparation's key, and that's something that I can honestly say that wasn't really a big part of my game even up to, 2 years ago. So to be able to see, there's a reason why, and I forget who said about it earlier in the program today, there's a reason why the best people are just different. And I saw that this year with some of arguably the best pitcher of our generation, and Justin Verlander, and how he prepares on a day-to-day basis, and how much that correlates to what has been said here tonight, is honestly preparation, and it's impressive, and it shows you how long and how. Why these people can play the game for so long.
So obviously good stuff there, Jim, from Derek Fisher, who's been rumored to be in trade rumors as well this offseason, another thing he's had to deal with. But what stood out the most to you?
Yeah, I just thought it was interesting. Like, I think I told him during the interview, you know, he's got to be the first guy at the rookie program who ever scored the winning run in a World Series game, you know, before he attended the rookie program. And, yeah, what's fun is, like Jonathan was saying, you know, some of the stuff you get that's not even on camera, it's not just, you know, the questions we ask these guys while we're rolling the tape, but, you know, sometimes, like, when we're trying to wait to interview three or four guys, you wind up talking to a guy for 10 or 15 minutes. And I had a good time reminiscing with him about the 2014 and 15 College World Series. He was part of the Virginia team in 14 that lost in the finals to Vanderbilt. Then he signed with the Astros, but watched from afar as they won the championship in 2015. And even though he wasn't an on-field participant, he did take a lot of pride in that. You know, a lot of these college programs that win championships, it's kind of a stepping stone. You don't just win the College World Series the first time you're out there, and you don't just win the Super Regionals the first time you get there. So even though he wasn't on the field when they won in 15, he did take a lot of pride in helping build the Virginia program up. And as you guys know, I can talk College World Series for a lot more than 10 or 15 minutes at a time, and I wound up talking to at least two Florida Gators in A.J. Puck, and I'm forgetting who my other Florida Gator was I spoke to, about them winning the championship this year after they were gone. So it's I talked a lot of College World Series with guys when we weren't necessarily rolling the cameras.
A lot of the guys you guys talked to had struggles that they had to cope with in 2017. We mentioned Telez, and Jonathan, you also talked to Justice Sheffield, who had to battle through an injury in 2017. Currently ranked number 4 in that Yankee system, that loaded Yankee system in the old rankings. He also was in the AFL. He talked a little bit about that. Let's hear from Justice Sheffield.
Very pleased with my season. You know, saw a lot of positives. Seems like the Yankees saw a lot of positives this year out of me also. Definitely had a great time going out to the Fall League. That was big for me, just to get back out there and, you know, get my innings back in or back under me and, you know, face those higher type guys and actually get out there and compete, because love to compete. So overall, I thought I had a great year, other than the injury, which you know, that wasn't good, but you know, overcame that. So looking forward to this year. It's weird because I think the injury happened for a reason. I think it was a learning experience, learning curve, since I've never been injured in my career. So it was definitely new to me to get over not being able to be out there on the field and, you know, overcome it and get back out there with my teammates. I think I was just kind of hungry to get back on the field. You know, missing those 2 months, which I thought I was going to be able to come back before playoffs even started. I thought I was going to, you know, get a few outings in before playoffs, but ended up not working out that way. So I think going to the Fall League, just being hungry and getting to go out on the field and compete again against, like I said, those top guys, you know, it's time to play ball. The way I look at it is I just got to go out there and do my thing, let the front office and things like that handle where they're going to put me or where I'll end up and things like that. But only thing I can do is just go out there and, you know, do what I do best, and that's get outs and, you know, help my team give my team a chance to win.
Sheffield's one of those guys, Jonathan, that's always been a good interview, right?
Yeah, he always has been. We talked to him in the Fall League, and he was great every time we needed to talk to him. He's a very confident young man. I think it can come across as cocky to some. But I'm okay with that. You know, I think that helps good players sometimes be great players, you know, to have that little bit of an edge. And he does. I think he's got a little bit of a chip on his shoulder. He wants to prove to people, you know, that he can get it done. And if he pitches like he did in the Fall League, he's going to have no problem. You know, and yeah, he was very good throughout the rookie career program. Actually, I heard good things about him interacting during the different sessions that they had, and he was great in this interview as well. He's just a well-spoken guy. I think it'll play well in New York once he gets there.
It seems to happen more often than you would expect that one of the players that ends up at the Rookie Career Development Program goes as a representative of one team, and by the time he leaves on Sunday, he's representing a different team. And that happened again here in 2018 as Trevor Oakes was traded to the Royals. After the trade, Jim, you were able to catch up with Trevor Oakes. Let's hear from Trevor.
I'm working on my changeup and my off-speed. Last year, I kind of had some troubles with my sinker, and you know, that's been my bread and butter for my career, and so far this offseason, it's been really good, and I've made some good adjustments and really kind of figured it out again. So I'm excited to show up to spring training with a fresh start and a new organization and show them, you know, what I'm all about and work quick and compete. You know, that's what I try to do. I'm just looking forward to competing and you know, seeing what that opportunity is in spring training.
So it's interesting because those guys get color-coded pullovers depending on what team they're on at the Rookie Career Development Program. Did Oaks have to trade his in gym and get a new color?
He did. We actually talked about that off camera, and we likened it to in the Arizona Fall League, where you literally cannot play if you're traded until you get the uniform for your new team. I think it was Daniel Polk a couple of years ago had to wait a day or two for a uniform. But no, we did talk about that, and it was quite striking because he was talking to Will Smith, who had been his teammate as late as Thursday night, and then suddenly a different organization. He had to trade, if I've got my pullovers correct, a kind of a bluish pullover for a greenish pullover. But, you know, and you know, again, I can't always remember exactly what was said during the interview compared to off camera. But it was kind of a shock to him, obviously. And then we explained that it does seem to happen more. We need to make a list. We talked about this, and we never put the list together. But it seems like it happens every couple of years, if not more than that, that one of these guys gets traded because the rookie program is always right after the break for Christmas and New Year's. And I think that's about the only week where baseball is relatively quiet and everybody gets back to work. And, you know, I'm surprised Jerry DePoto didn't make like six trades like that first week to make up for the time he took off. But anyway, you know, it was a shock to him. But he tried to look at it as positive that, one, I mean, obviously if you get traded, somebody else wants you. You know, they ask for you in the trade. And two, you know, while, you know, the Dodgers are the only organization he's ever known, it's not any secret if you look at the rosters that he's going to have a lot easier time trying to crack the Royals rotation than he would the Dodgers rotation. I mean, the Royals are rebuilding. Their pitching's not nearly as strong as the Dodgers, who were one win away from winning the World Series and have, you know, a really deep collection of pitchers. You know, Oaks has spent the last 2 years, the majority of it in AAA. He's one of the better. He's got one of the better ground out, air out ratios in the minors. He relies a lot on his heavy sinker, and he's going to get a better opportunity. So while it was a shock, and I think it's sad. I mean, he was, like I said, he spent a lot of time when I saw him hanging out with Will Smith, who he was teammates with in the Dodger system this year, you know, and you know, last year as well. You know, he's, you know, moving on from Dodgers to Kansas City, and you know, it's probably good for his career.
Yeah, interesting way to meet some of your new teammates is like, hey, I'm on your team now. Can we do breakfast here at the RCDP? Interesting. Biggest name guy I can think of in relatively recent years was Chris Archer, I think, Jonathan. Is that right? Chris,
yep.
Archer was traded, was it from Cleveland to Tampa Bay at the RCDP?
It would have been Chicago to Tampa Bay.
Chicago to Tampa Bay, okay.
Is that right, Jim?
Yeah, he was originally drafted by the Indians, but got traded for Mark DeRosa, who's the second greatest Penn grad that we've mentioned during this podcast. And and then got traded.
We didn't talk about Doug Glanville.
That's right. There we go.
Uh-uh.
And then he got traded. I can't remember who he got traded for. Was it Garza? It must have been Garza, right? Yeah. I think it was Matt Garza.
Yeah,
trade.
I think so. So that, yeah, he definitely was the biggest prospect. And then I remember when Ross Ohlendorf was traded to the Yankees for Randy Johnson. And I don't know if you've ever talked to Ross Ohlendorf. He's a really smart guy, Princeton guy, but a little bit quiet, a little bit reserved. And it afforded him the opportunity to actually practice doing interviews, talking about being traded for Randy Johnson. And you know, when he was going into a large market where people were going to want to talk to him, so in some ways he was in a really good place for something like that to happen.
And I want to say a couple of years ago, in 2015, which I think was the last one before this year that we both attended, Daniel Robertson got traded. There was a like six player trade or five player trade. I'm looking here. It was the A's traded Daniel Robertson, John Jaso, and Boog Powell and Cash for Ben Zobrist and Yunel Escobar of the Rays. I remember having to track down Daniel Roberts. It, like I say, we need to figure out a master list of these, but it does seem to happen more often than not. And like I said, I think it's always kind of a shock because you literally leave home and fly to Virginia to be part of the rookie program as a member of one organization, and then all of a sudden you're in a different organization.
Yeah, it's a little trip down RCDP memory lane. Good stuff, guys. Again, I want to mention the timeline for the top 10 positional prospect list coming out. They start Tuesday, and it'll be pretty much every day, every weekday from there, starting with right-handed pitchers to lefties, catchers, first base, second base, third base, shortstops, and outfielders. And then the top 100 list will be unveiled on January 27th. That'll do it for another edition of the Pipeline Podcast. For Jim Callis and Jonathan Mayo, I'm Tim McMaster. Tune in again next time.